Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And let me remind you, because usually when I do content, I forget to tell you that that debt in that debt clock is fraud. So as we kind of move forward, and welcome back, Tammy. I really appreciate your patience and assistance in going through this, because it makes it a little easier when somebody's kind of going through it for the first time. As they start absorbing it, they go, wow, I did not realize this. And so you can kind of see how from the Assumption Act, how Hamilton set the stage to, one, start creating an invigorous tax, and we didn't really cover that because there's really no debates. The only debate that there was that one could probably find, and it wasn't that big of a deal because Hamilton ended up conceding, was the type of taxes that they needed to create for making money. Because, again, the whole point of the Assumption Act was, one, to create a level of debt that the federal government would now have to put some real taxes on the states. And one of the first taxes that Hamilton proposed was a horse tax. It was a tax on the sale of horses. And it was identified by Madison and many of the other Southern members of Congress that that tax would be unfair because the majority of the horses were in the South. And the states that had the most transactions in the sale of horses was in the South. So in other words, the tax that would be levied in an excise tax or sales type, the type of tax on the sale of horses, would basically be the burden of the South, where the North, they may buy a horse, but they keep that horse and they don't use horses to, you know, to grow their food like they do in the South. I mean, the horsepower, that was their tractors. That was their mode of being able to be productive. And in the North, it was their hands and skills and so forth. So there was a huge disparity. And so they had to come up with another form of tax. And believe it or not, out the gate after the Assumption Act and after that fiasco, and while they were debating this bank, the establishment of the bank in the beginning of 1791, Hamilton finally concluded that the one thing that America used as a staple, like milk or flour, was distilled liquor. In other words, whiskey. Because actually, it was a form of liquid grain. That's the liquor that they had. I mean, they may have had moonshine. They may have had really strong drink. But the average whiskey was more of a grain product, if you know what I'm saying. It was fermented. It was a whiskey, but it still gave them nutrients. At least that's how they, you know, saw it. And in those days, they didn't have refrigeration, so when they, you know, couldn't actually produce flour or what have you, alcohol was one of those things that kind of tied them through. Believe it or not, they actually considered whiskey a staple, and everybody had their, I guess, their way of coping. I know John Adams spoke always that he had to have his hard apple cider in the morning. That's how he started his day. So it's kind of like the wine in the Middle East and so forth. I mean, the only way you could preserve juices was to actually distill it so that it had liquor so that it would preserve for years.
Right.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, now they got this whiskey tax going, and America is going to be stewing on this. And it was actually challenged in Pennsylvania and a few other states. And actually, in the process of getting the whiskey tax, there was a debate in Congress regarding a use of federal funds to cover a bounty on cod fisheries so that they could actually increase productivity and actually kind of create a protection for the fishermen up in the Northeast. And so what we're going to do is, and I'll kind of read the introduction to this, we're going to cover the bounty payments for cod fisheries. This is 6 February 1792. So it's kind of like 1 year after the bank, the debates on the bank, right?
Right.
Okay. So on 3 February 1792, the Committee of the Whole, in other words, the entire body of the House of Representatives, began consideration of the bill for encouragement of the cod fisheries as passed by the Senate. Now, the first section of the bill placed the existing drawback, which was the importation duty on salts. So, in other words, they were putting a tax on the salts coming in that were being exported from other nations to the exporters of the salted fish with a new base on tonnage to the owners for the fishing vessels. So, in other words, for them to preserve fish, because in those days, again, no refrigeration, they actually salted meats and cured them and so forth. And so if you've ever had salted fish, I don't think I could stand that. But anyway, the debate basically was centered on the advantage which the bill bestowed on New England or the New England states, and stressed the importance of the fisheries as a source of trained sailors in case of war. So see how they're kind of tying this together to say, we need to do this because we need to sustain this productivity, because this productivity sustains this need for having an available fleet of Navy. Now, keep in mind, the Constitution in Article 1, Section 8, and let me see here. I'm going to say it is subsection 12, to provide and maintain a Navy. In other words, the one thing that the nation had to do, or I should say Congress was responsible for, because they weren't supposed to have a standing army. They could call for the militia to basically federalize and have an army, but the funding would be limited because they wanted to make sure that the federal government did not have the ability to maintain an army so that they could create laws and use the army to enforce their laws. Okay, so, and we're going to dive into that with the Whiskey Rebellion. So the one thing that they needed to do was they needed to have a Navy. Well, Washington was not a sailor, right? I mean, he was a ground pounder. He was an infantryman and a cavalryman. I mean, his life was on the ground in the army. And so he didn't have this, you know, this real urge or this drive to create a Navy. And it wasn't, you know, the foremost thing on their mind. And as a matter of fact, even Hamilton downplayed the need of a Navy. And it wasn't until John Adams became president that said, we need to do this. Because, of course, going back to John Adams being up in New England, they felt the necessity of actually starting to build a Navy. And Thomas Jefferson, as the vice president, gave him a lot of flack about, you know, him spending so much effort and money and resources in creating and basically following the Constitution by providing and maintaining a Navy. So Anyway, and see, these kind of things are all intersecting because this is what they needed to do because the Navy was the one safeguard from the external threats.
Right.
And the intent behind the Army was as a home defense. The framers never fathomed putting Army on ships and going, you know, abroad. We weren't going to go fight wars outside the United States. The intent was, which is why we had a militia, not an army, so that we would be prepared to defend ourselves. And so, technically, the projection of force was strictly with the Navy and the Marine Corps. And based on the design of the Constitution, the Army was never to deploy. So how they got there was completely in ignoring the design and ignoring what they should have been doing. Because if they wanted to bolster the deployment of forces, they would have had to bolster the Marine Corps and the Navy to do that. Because then because the Marine Corps would never be involved in enforcing laws in America. The Navy wouldn't be firing, and it wouldn't be basically, you know, invading America with the Marines. In other words, the whole focus, and that's what these guys, that was their focus and job, was to worry about foreign threats. Mm-hmm. The Army, as they started expanding and as Manifest Destiny started moving westward, they started creating a standing army so that they would have a presence in these new territories to defend the interests of the United States against the Indians and other foreign entities that were out there harassing us, like the French, or I should say actually the British and other nations that were out there. So anyway, let's dive into the debate, though, because at this point, we're seeing this justification of, you know, needing to have money and maintaining these fisheries or this fishing business. Because when I think fisheries, I think of like these big ponds where they, you know, cultivate fish, you know, like salmon or what have you, and they release them so that they capture them later. But this is actually the process of going out, catching fish, bringing them back and processing them so that they can sell the fish and, mm-hmm. you know, and export it abroad and so forth. So anyway, Mr. Livermore now actually is talking on the floor, and this is basically how they capture what he said. So go ahead. We'll start off with Mr. Livermore. Go ahead.
Okay. The bill now under consideration has two important objects in view. The one is to give encouragement to our fishermen and by that encouragement to increase their numbers. The other is to govern those fishermen by certain laws by which they will be kept under due restraint. Both these objects are of great importance to such person as choose to employ their capitals in the fishery business, and I believe it will not be disrupted that the business itself is of considerable importance to the United States, insomuch as it affords a certain proportion of remittance or exportation to foreign countries and does not impoverish the country, but enriches it by the addition of so much wealth drawn from the sea.
Okay, so right there, one of the things that he lays out, because he's talking about two points here. One is that it gives encouragement to the fishermen and that increasing of the numbers of that. The other thing is to govern fishermen by certain laws by which they will be kept under due restraint. So in other words, here is, and actually this didn't get into real play, because usually when things come out like a bill like this, 9 times out of 10, you find one point to just say, you know, just on this one point alone, it, you know, we can't do this. But with this, there was actually a lot of points that they could have easily made. One of those points is that this is not a delegated power within the Constitution to regulate fisheries, to regulate the commerce. Remember, the Commerce Clause tells the federal government that they have the power to regulate commerce among the states. This is commerce that will be operating within states.
Right.
And so I don't believe we'll see anything in here where they even say, hey, you realize that including these regulations that you're going to place upon them, this actually becomes a violation. This is something that we just don't have the authority to do. But that didn't come up. I don't think we'll find this at all. But it's a point that's necessary because they always try to create these grand sweeping, blah, here, this is what we want to do, and we want to regulate this, we're going to make money, this is going to stimulate us, plus there's these other things. So go ahead to the next paragraph.
Okay, it is the object of those gentlemen who favor the bill that the fishermen should have some encouragement not given to them at the expense of the United States, but directed to them out of what was in the former law, called a drawback of the duty on salt. The calculation, as I understand it, has been made as nearly as possible to give that drawback not to the merchants who export the fish, but to the fishermen who take it, in order to increase that description of men, without whose assistance it is vain to expect any benefit from the fisheries. For if the merchants at present engaged in that branch possessed the whole capital of the United States, yet, if they cannot get fishermen, they cannot carry on the fishery. This is done by a particular class of men who must not only expert seamen, but also accustomed to taking the fish and curing it. If these men cannot be had, the capital cannot be employed, and those who undertake the business cannot carry it on or reap any profit from it.
Okay, so the capital they're talking about is the money, the profits. And yeah. So he's basically saying that they want to make sure that they're bolstering and help funding the process of catching and curing, you know, to make that commodity available. And they're not actually trying to create the benefit for those merchants who are going to sell and export. Okay, so in other words, once they catch these fish, they're going to cure these fish, and then they will basically sell it, you know, as a whatever their markup is out to the exporters. So they're going to get the drawback themselves on the salt that they're purchasing from the importers. So it, without getting into the importing and exporting intricacies, the focus here was to ensure that the benefit would be realized by the fishermen and the process of both fishing and curing to create the product for exportation. So go ahead.
Okay. Whilst the drawback is payable only to the merchant who exports the fish, it is impossible to convince the fishermen that they reap from it, any advantage whatever. Or, if the more discerning amongst them do perceive any advantage in it, the others who are not so clear-sighted cannot discern it, and are therefore not disposed to undertake the business. It is, however, of considerable importance to the merchants that the fishermen should receive the proper encouragement, even if they were obliged to allow him a bounty out of their own pocket.
Okay, go ahead. Okay, keep going.
The government of the fishermen, after their engagement in this business, is also necessary to be provided for. Otherwise, frequent instances may occur among that class of men of quitting one vessel to embark on board another, or of shipping themselves for a foreign voyage before the expiration of the fishing season. In the latter case, the vessel lies useless on the owner's hands, and he, together with the whole expense of the outfit, loses all his prospects of future gain.
Okay, so they're basically saying that right now they're barely getting by. So they've got to try to figure out a way to help stimulate. So this technically is what the first bill that is presented to say, we need to stimulate some commerce. We need to stimulate a sector, a market, specific market space, i.e. fisheries, in America so that we can maintain this. So keep going.
The government of the fishermen, after their engagement in this business, is also necessary to be provided for. Otherwise, frequent instances may occur among that class of men of quitting one vessel. Did I just read that?
Yes, you did. Yeah.
Okay, moving on to the next one.
Okay.
The two objects here mentioned are fully provided for in the bill. Still, however, it is objected to. But what is the objection? It is that the word bounty is twice used in this clause. Let us now see what advantage will result from striking out this obnoxious bounty. None at all. The bill says it shall seize and have gentlemen. Any objection to the bounty seizing? The bill says it shall seize and having gentlemen. Any objection to the bounty seizing? It's a question. Since the bounty is to seize by this bill, what advantage in striking it out? The sense will still remain the same. I do not know why we should make a law expressly to strike out the word bounty, but to strike out the bounty itself.
Okay, keep going. So it's just he's talking about the language and so forth, but he's also talking about the necessity of passing this bill. Go ahead.
It is strange to me that any gentleman, whether he is for giving a great bounty or no bounty at all, should quarrel with this unfortunate word. There is, indeed, one part of the section which I will readily consent to strike out, and I believe every other gentleman who is in favor of the bill will consent to likewise, and that is the clause which provides the bounty to be allowed and paid on every vessel for one season shall not exceed $170. If, when the vote is taken on the section, there does not appear a majority of the House in favor of striking out the whole, we may then move for striking out the proviso, if it be offensive to any gentleman. If it be not offensive, it may remain.
Okay, so he's basically laying out that they're putting a cap on what they're going to be able to pay or subsidize, which was $170. So, in other words, they were trying to create or remove the stigma of saying, well, we're paying a bounty, and instead, they just basically are going to be subsidizing, but they didn't use that word. But bottom line, they were looking at ensuring that the ships on this drawback, or basically, it is a like a tax deduction or what have you, where they're instead of paying a bounty, because they want to strike that out, because it comes across as that they're rewarding and or paying out. And so they wanted to make sure that, one, every vessel would be able to benefit, but the maximum benefit for this salt drawback would be $170 for a year. Just imagine if that's the amount of money that it would take for somebody to be able to maintain a profitable business back in those days, $170 a year.
Wow.
I mean, that's just a decent night out on the town.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So keep going.
Hey, if gentlemen are disputing only because the word bounty is in the bill, they may be perfectly relieved from their uneasiness on that score, for the bill expressly says that the bounty now allowed upon the exportation of dried fish of the fisheries of the United States shall cease, and in lieu thereof, a different kind of encouragement is to be given. Here is no reason to dispute about a word. If gentlemen are disposed to consent to the principle of the bill, that the drawback of the duties on salt shall be commuted for a certain sum to encourage the fishermen, they will vote in favor of the bill. If not, they will vote against it. But it is impossible for me to conceive.
Okay, so at this point, you're probably hearing that we're being overcome. I forgot that we actually need to keep track of this. But as we're going through this, as a matter of fact, you'll find that we actually have these breaks, and forgive me, Tammy. So anyway, we're going to take a pause. We'll dive back into this paragraph when we come back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so just as a quick explanation, Tammy can't hear, you know, just like with Paul, and since Tammy's new, we'll try to be better at this, but Tammy actually can't hear the music when it starts playing, and so until she actually hears me talking and cutting out, and so what we have to do is I need to be better watching this, but anywho, as we were covering, well, let's just pick it up from the beginning of that paragraph, if you would, please.
Okay. The gentlemen are disputing only because the word bounty is in the bill. They may be perfectly relieved from their uneasiness on that score, for the bill expressly says that the bounty now allowed upon the exportation of dried fish of the fisheries of the United States shall cease, and in lieu thereof, a different kind of encouragement is to be given. Here is no reason to dispute about a word. If gentlemen are disposed to consent to the principle of the bill, that the drawback of the duties on salt shall be commuted for a certain sum to encourage the fishermen, they will vote in favor of the bill. If not, they will vote against it. But it is impossible for me to conceive why any gentleman under heaven should be against it. It is only fixing, for the merchants engaged in this branch, a clear and equitable ratio for distributing among the fishermen that encouragement which they think necessary in order to attach those people to the business and to prevent them from going to other occupations on land. The bill is an important one and will increase the branch of business, which is very useful to the community. It does not lay a farthing of bounty or duty on any other persons than those who are immediately concerned in it. It will serve them and will not injure anybody.
Okay, so again, it's creating a benefit. Now, one of the things we've covered already is in Article 1, Section 8, this uniformity. So when we look at the burdens being created by government, if government creates an advantage from one market sector that actually creates an advantage for a few states and not all the states equally, then it's actually violating the essence of providing a mutual and uniform benefit. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's that problem, and I don't think that even gets addressed here. What really gets addressed, because Madison basically focuses in this particular case on this concept of common defense and the general defense and welfare clause, because they're using the justification as using the money coming into the treasury to pay for something that would benefit the common defense and welfare of these particular states in the north. Now, I think this is where we dive into Mr. Lawrence, right? So Mr. Mm-hmm. Lawrence then basically speaks. They make a few different comments. Actually, they capture a few different comments from Mr. Lawrence. And then we will get into Madison. So go ahead and cover Mr. Lawrence here.
Okay. Mr. Lawrence said, From examining this section, he conceived it contemplated no more than what the merchant is entitled to by existing laws. The merchant is now entitled to the drawback, but it is found by experience that the effect has not been to produce that encouragement to the fisherman which was expected. He presumed the way was perfectly clear to give a new direction to the drawback, and this is all that is aimed at in the bill. He supposed that the clause had no necessary connection with the question which had been started respecting the right of the government to grant bounties. But since the question has been brought forward, it may be proper to consider it. In discussing the question, he inquired, "What has Congress already done? Have we not laid extra duties on various articles expressly for the purpose of encouraging various branches of our own manufacturers? These duties are bounties to all intent and purposes and are founded on the idea only of their conducing to the general interest. Similar objections to those now advanced were not made to these duties. They were advocated, some of them, by gentlemen from the southward. He traced the effects of these duties and showed that they operated fully as indirect bounties."
Okay, so go ahead and read the next one, because they're basically capturing or summarizing his justification. So we'll just dive into that, and then we'll take a pause to talk about, you know, how he's just basically saying, hey, you know, why not do this? And we're already doing this in other capacities and other ways. We're just trying to provide an advantage for these states. But keep going.
Okay. Mr. Lawrence then adverted particularly to the Constitution and observed that it contains general principles and powers only. These powers depend on particular laws for their operation, and on this idea he contended that the powers of the government must, in various circumstances, extend to the granting bounties. He instanced, in case of a war with a foreign power, will any gentleman say that the general government has not a power to grant a bounty on arms, ammunition, etc.? Should the general welfare require it? The general welfare is inseparably connected with any object or pursuit which in its effects adds to the riches of the country. He conceived that the argument was given up by gentlemen in opposition to the bill when they admit of encouragement to the fishermen and any possible modification of it. He then adverted particularly to the fisheries, stated the number of men employed, the tons of shipping necessary to export the fish taken, and inferred the sound policy of encouraging so important a branch of business. Gentlemen say that we do not want a navy. Granted. But can they say that we shall never have a war with any European power? May not the time arrive when the protection to the commerce of this country derived from this may be of the utmost necessity to its existence? Adverting to Mr. Williamson's objection from the unequal operation of bounties, and who had referred to the article of the Constitution which says that taxes shall be equal in all the states.
All right, so there is a reference to the uniformity clause, and actually, before you read the last part, before we dive into Madison, he also starts off with this in this paragraph. He says, "Gentlemen say that we do not want a navy." Now, the Constitution demands that they create and maintain a navy. Right? I read that, right?
Yeah.
So, how is it that Congress can actually say, we don't want a navy?
Yeah.
In other words, I will just say it is, what is the best word for it? When we look at a dereliction of duty, because here the Constitution basically says they need to form or create and maintain a Navy. And the fact that they hadn't done it, and as a matter of fact, because, again, Washington didn't set that tone. Washington, as a matter of fact, in all fairness, You know, we're trying to lick our wounds. We just recovered from hosting a Revolutionary War. There were lots of inner problems, rebuilding, these types of things, just getting on top of the debt. And so Washington wanted to basically create a stable nation without really going boom to bust. And as a matter of fact, the one thing that they should have done, instead of assuming the debts from the states, is they actually should have said, we need to create a vigorous Navy, that every state will actually, and they start apportioning out to each of the states how many ships and the port necessities, so that they could actually start creating this defense. Because they did not do that, it actually created more of a red welcome mat to Britain in 1812, because we just never, they started in Adams' administration, they started doing it, and then Thomas Jefferson kind of took it over, but they didn't do it in a serious enough tone to where Britain was able to actually float up the Potomac and blow up D.C. In the War of 1812, they literally burnt down Washington, D.C. because they didn't create the, you know, I'll just say the necessary fortifications with Navy ships and so forth, like a Coast Guard, to keep that from happening. But here the Constitution demanded it. And here, to me, this is a huge flag. This is a dereliction of duty, because these men wanted to actually pursue advantages for their, in other words, let's throw a stipend. Let's, you know, make New England more successful in their fisheries because we're going to stimulate the business up there. Anyway, I mean, there's so many things that were just wrong about this, but go ahead, finish the last part, and then we'll just go straight into Madison. So go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Lawrence observed that this article in the Constitution could only respect the rates of the duties, and that the same duties should be paid in Virginia that are paid in New York, at the northward as at the southward. It surely could not mean that every individual should pay exactly the same sum in every part of the Union. This was a provision that no law could possibly contemplate. He concluded by a summary recapitulation of his arguments, saying he hoped the section would be retained.
Okay, so he's hoping that this moves forward. Now, the guy in the room that is probably the most prepared to actually debate or discuss an issue, because nine times out of ten, when Madison would step forward, he was very intimidating. He was the smallest president we've ever had, but he was intimidating because when he went up to the lectern, when he went up to what people call a podium, but when he went up to the lectern to speak, he actually brought books with him. And he would put those books there, and when he would go through them, and that's why, if you remember, when he was debating on the Bank Act, remember, he started reading from the ratification debates. He was holding these three state ratification debates as he was going through these things. So here's Madison now, and he's actually getting up to say something. And I think this is one of those debates where he doesn't have anything that he cites. He actually takes people down a path that they weren't prepared for. Now, let's set the stage. At this point in time, each state had has their own state-sponsored religion. And so there's a church that is providing in each of the states compassionate services. In other words, the church is providing education, the church is providing the health care, job training, job placement, welfare. They are the ones that are making and helping the people survive and, you know, become self-sufficient, right? The government is not involved in that. They're just basically protecting life and private property. And ensuring that the people are secure to do what they need to do in their religious lives, because that was their life. As a matter of fact, Alexis de Tocqueville, when he came to America, he realized the uniqueness of America, because America was so centered on community and faith. He said, and this is basically the one that kind of rings out of one of his greatest quotations, America is great because America is good. They're religiously righteous, good people. In other words, that they don't need laws to regulate their morality. The churches were doing that. In other words, the churches were the essential part, the fabric of our society that got us, and basically with the conscience of people, you didn't want to be shamed. You didn't want to be looked down upon by your whole community.
Right.
So everybody was kind of working together, and this is a form of enlightenment that America has lost. So as we kind of look at this huge separation, and I'm not using the Thomas Jefferson separation, a wall of separation, there was literally a very specific function for government. And then church and the local government, state and local government, was the world to everybody. In other words, this federal government didn't mingle and get involved. And here they're actually talking about getting involved in these fisheries. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about getting involved in very specific markets for very specific reasons. So now Madison, sorry about that. So now Madison actually gets up, and now he wants to create this wake-up call. And as he goes through this, he basically does what I call shock value. If you've ever heard somebody that on the radio or in, in entertainment, like the day the earth stood still, I think it was Orson Welles or whoever did that radio show where we were being invaded, and it was just an entertainment thing. But people literally jumped out their window. People killed themselves when they heard that we were being invaded by these aliens from outer space. And it was just a shock value to just kind of, hey, are we even ready for something like that? But it was strictly done in a mode of entertainment. Well, what Madison is doing is he's basically shocking these people to say, here's a harsh reality if we start going down this path. So I'll let you take it from there.
Okay. So, Mr. Madison, in the conflict I feel between my disposition, on one hand, to afford every constitutional encouragement to the fisheries, and my dislike, on the other, of the consequences apprehended from some clauses in the bill, I should have forborne to enter into this discussion if I had not found that, over and above such arguments as appear to be natural and pertinent to the subject, others have been introduced which are, in my judgment, contrary to the true meaning and even strike at the characteristic principles of the Constitution. That's a long sentence. Let me premise, however, to the remarks which I shall briefly offer on the doctrine maintained by these gentlemen, that I make a material distinction in the present case between an allowance as a mere commutation and modification of a drawback, and an allowance in the nature of a real and positive bounty. I make a distinction also, as a subject of fair consideration at least, between a bounty granted under the particular terms in the Constitution, a power to regulate trade, and one granted under it, in definite terms which have been cited as authority on this occasion. I think, however, that the term bounty is in every point of view improper as it is here applied, not only because it may be offensive to some, and in the opinion of others, carries a dangerous implication, but also because it does not express the true intention of the bill as avowed and advocated by its patrons themselves. For if in the allowance, nothing more is proposed than a mere reimbursement of a sum of advanced It is only paying a debt. And when we pay a debt, we ought not to claim the merit of granting a bounty.
Okay, so he's kind of laying it out. And apparently, you know, they use these things called bounties because they also they brought it up earlier that if we had to go to war, clearly the federal government would pay a bounty for manufacturers to start manufacturing arms because they would have to buy arms. And so they would probably, you know, and this kind of is how we as a nation, like with World War II, when FDR said we need green dye so that we can paint all of our tanks and you know, camouflage ourselves because we're going to war, what he did was he basically put a full freeze. You couldn't buy anything with green. And the old cigarettes, Lucky Strike, they used a green dye for the paper for Lucky Strike. They actually said, okay, the federal government seized all green dye and everything else so that they could use this for the pigment and coloring of the uniforms and the and tanks and all of that. So the commercial market and we the people didn't have green. As a matter of fact, not only did he take green, he actually shut down the production of automobiles and rubber tires and those types of things for something like 2 years.
Yeah.
And the resurgence of tires and those types of things in the market space became slow to recover. Let's just say that. And one of the things that people had to start doing so that they could, you know, use their tires longer was they started putting tubes in their tires.
Mm.
Or actually, I think that that's what they did. They actually started doing tire repairs, patching, and that type of stuff so that they could get more mileage out of it. And I actually believe that the cars actually had tubes, but instead of replacing tires, what they were doing, they actually had to make them last longer because you just couldn't buy tires. So they had to start creating repair kits and that type of stuff. So anyway, you know, when all of a sudden you can't have something, we have to innovate and figure out what to do to get by without. So anyway, let's keep going. And so he's going to go through and he's setting the stage for where he literally just starts slapping people in the face with reality. Because the again, it goes back to this one thing, the being able to spend money for the common or for the general defense and welfare of the unions. Keep going.
It is supposed by some gentlemen that Congress have authority not only to grant bounties in the sense here used merely as a commutation for drawbacks, but even to grant them under a power by virtue of which they may do anything which they may think conducive to the general welfare. This, sir, in my mind, raises the important and fundamental question whether the general terms which had been cited are to be considered as a sort of caption or general description of the specified powers, and as having no further meaning and giving no further power than what is found in that specification, or as an abstract and indefinite delegation of power extending to all cases, whatever, to all such at least as will admit the application of money, which is giving as much latitude as any government could well desire.
Okay, so here he's basically saying that, you know, it seems like the one thing that we're, you know, we're just being carefree about is the money. The using this latitude of just going and printing money and at this point in time in 1792, they just came out with the first Bank Act. And as a matter of fact, we should probably dive into that before we get into the Whiskey Rebellion. So I'll have to give you those documentation because I think going through the first Bank Act will help everybody see how they created the stabilization of our economy. But anyway, let's keep going.
I, sir, have always conceived, I believe those who proposed the Constitution conceived, It is still more fully known and more material to observe those who ratified the Constitution conceived that this is not an indefinite government deriving its powers from the general terms prefixed to the specified powers, but a limited government tied down to the specified powers which explain and define the general terms.
Okay. Okay, so right there. Did you see what he did? Now, he already did this during the Bank and the Assumption Acts. He actually cited the ratification. And he basically says, I conceived, and I believe those who proposed the Constitution conceived, and it is even still more fully known and more material to observe, those who ratified the Constitution conceived. In other words, here were the people themselves that accepted the Constitution as it was being sold to them, that this is not an indefinite government deriving its powers from general terms prefixed to the specified powers, but a limited and tied down to the specified powers which explain and define the general terms. Does that make sense? So here he's basically saying, look, you know, it doesn't matter what we're here thinking. There's this group called the states, the people's delegates that actually ratified this Constitution. And we sold this thing and told them that this is how we're going to operate. And that's not what's happening here. But he hasn't said that yet. But go ahead. Keep going.
Okay, the gentlemen who contend for a contrary doctrine are surely not aware of the consequences which flow from it, in which they must either admit or give up their doctrine.
Okay, so now here comes the shock value. Go ahead.
It will follow, in the first place, that if the terms be taken in the broad sense they maintain, the particular powers afterwards, so carefully and distinctly enumerated, would be without meaning and must go for nothing. It will be absurd
Tammy, yeah. I'm going to stop you right there. Okay. And that's only because this is really important, because he's laying out, remember, in Article 1, Section 8, at the very beginning is the preamble, and it says Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, but all duties, imposts, taxes shall be uniform. So all they're doing here is they're basically saying we're going to have the power to basically tax for money and to be able to spend this money for, you know, these general purposes of the general defense and welfare of the United States. So that's the preamble. And then what he basically has just said here is he goes, what Congress may do after the raise of money is, okay. It will follow in the first place that the terms must be taken in a broad sense to maintain the particular powers afterwards so carefully and distinctly enumerated. So what he just said right there is after this general power, actually we've just ran out of time. Wow, I can't believe it. So, folks, what we're going to do is we're going to actually pick it up from the beginning of the shock value in our next episode. And I'm going to have to beg, because this is twice in one show, I'll have to beg Tammy to forgive me for actually missing the fact that we were running out of time. That's what happens when you get caught up, though. I'll tell you that it's so easy to do. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract. and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.